On this week's episode of the Physio Foundations podcast, I'm going to talk to Tihan Chandramohan, also known as or aka the cricket physio, about his experiences in recovering from a major injury and what he's learned so far wearing the patient's shoes. Welcome back to the Physio Foundations podcast, where we talk about the knowledge and skills that provide the foundation of expert clinical practice. So today I'm talking to Tihan Chandramohan, aka the cricket physio, about the insights that he has had so far on his rehab journey from a major injury. So if you follow Tihan online, you may have followed some of this. He's been quite honest and I guess really quite an interesting summary of his rehab process or his rehab experience he's had so far after an ankle injury. And I thought it was a really good opportunity to chat to him about this and reflect on some of the insights and the things he's learned on the journey so far, because it gets to the heart of one of the most important foundational skills, or perhaps it's a state of mind that many previous guests have brought up so far on the podcast. And that's the ability to see things from the patient's perspective and to have empathy and balance that empathy with clinical reasoning. So I think you're going to find this one really interesting. Tihan's the perfect guest to explore the topic with. He's a highly experienced sports physio. He's worked in international cricket for many years, and he has a wealth of experience in helping people recover from their injuries and from surgery. And now, unfortunately, he has his own personal experience in recovering from a serious injury, but also a good opportunity for us to reflect on how we can better support people who are going through a similar thing. So let's bring him on. Tihan, welcome to Physio Foundations.
G'day, Luke. Thanks for the introduction and the welcome. Looking forward to having a chat today.
So good to see you again. I last saw you at the Sports Medicine Australia National Conference. Was that last October or so? And we had a good chat then. And then since then, you've been traveling overseas and then you've had a motorbike versus pedestrian accident we're going to talk about today. But before we go there, let's go back a bit. Have I missed anything in my introduction? You're also a podcast host.
Yeah. So look, I mean, as you said in your intro, I've been a physio for more than 20 years now, which doesn't feel like it, but that's the case. When you look at the timeframes, it feels like yesterday that I started. And yeah, the last 15 years, I've really specialized into doing sport, especially cricket, and basically doing that full time, both in Australia and overseas. And then the most recent job that I had was based out of Sri Lanka. I was the rehab manager for Sri Lanka cricket, looking after the whole island from international cricket all the way down to grassroots, and looking at ways to improve the systems in a developing country, which is really a really interesting role. And then while I was there on New Year's Eve, I got hit by a motorbike walking across the road after a few drinks on New Year's Eve. Thankfully, I wasn't even that drunk. Just a busy road, and I didn't quite judge. Sometimes in subcontinental countries, the road rules are guidelines rather than rules. And
right.
I didn't quite get the memo on that evening and got clipped by a motorbike at pace and fractured my left tibia and fibula, sort of proximal mid-shaft, so pretty high up the leg.
Yeah,
I remember it quite well, which shows I wasn't that drunk. and I remember it as the bike hit me, I felt the leg break. And so these are the sort of things as a physio, when you're doing a subjective and you ask people about these sort of things, a lot of the time you don't get this information because usually, especially as a physio with a lower limb fracture, you're usually not seeing them acutely. I've seen a few in like AFL and stuff, and you're definitely not asking the bloke how he's feeling. Yeah. He's usually rolling around the ground, screaming with his leg in a different funny angle. So, you know, this was the first time for me as a person experiencing it. And I've had those conversations with people about the fact that, you know, they didn't feel pain, and we kind of put that down to shock, or, you know, you'd think something as aggressive and acute as a major lower limb fracture would be a really painful event. And I can tell you right now, at that time and even post the acute incident happening, I didn't have any pain. And that was a really interesting moment for me to think, actually, you know, when we talk about pain not being associated with pathology, well, there was pathology there, and my body didn't tell me anything was painful. As I said, I knew it was broken. I could feel that happen, but it wasn't pain that was giving me the feedback. And that was a really interesting thing for me to experience, because I'd never really experienced that kind of thing before. I've had a few other small fractures. I can tell you those things hurt, but this one definitely didn't. And what that comes down to is obviously a complex interplay of physiology and neurology and context and all those other things that happen. But that was a really interesting thing at the very start that I would not have been able to tell you prior to this happening to me. And so, look, it was a significant fracture, you know, me walking across the road, motorbike hitting me with two people on it. So I had a fair bit of weight behind it. And so I had to get looked after in Sri Lanka, which, you know, developing country. Luckily, I was the rehab manager for the cricket team. So I got looked after really well there. There was, you know, I knew all of the people that you need to have involved and got the best people to look after me and got looked after really quickly. And basically I had surgery that day. Within 24 hours, I'd had an intramedullary rod put in my left tibia. They straightened everything up. I obviously had a fairly large amount of soft tissue trauma and hematomas and some, some tire tracks on my leg. But thankfully it was a closed fracture. So there was no actual, open wound from the incident. So there was no risk of external infection from the road getting me. They were very careful about that, but obviously in developing countries, the biggest risk from these sort of things is infection.
Okay, yeah.
And they were really, very cognizant of that. And having been in a lot of operating theatres, I've been very lucky in my career that having worked with athletes, I've probably been in more operating theatres than most physios, watching orthopedic surgeons doing multiple different kinds of surgery from upper limb, lower limb, spinal surgeries. I've seen a lot. Australia, in the UK. I haven't seen a lot in Sri Lanka. It just didn't happen while I was there. But having seen it from the patient's side, a very different experience in the operating theatre and the levels of hygiene and processes and the people involved and how the whole workflow occurs in these sort of places where resources are limited and, education and processes aren't up to the standards that we expect. It was a very different experience that first 24 hours of all of this happening and having an accident and getting to the hospital and all those things I remember quite well. And I thankfully I started writing it down straight away so I wouldn't forget. So I've got all of those things as they happened. I've written them down. And those were the things that sort of stood out to me at the very start that I never really thought about or experienced before, either as a physio or as a patient prior to the incident happening.
Did you write them down to reflect on them later or to potentially have something to talk about on future podcasts or online? Or was it more for a personal reflection on what was going on and journaling, documenting things?
At the time, it was probably more that it had never happened before. And I always think about that in hindsight, I should have written that down. So I was like, while I'm doing it and I'm sitting in a hospital room with time, I had plenty of time and I was otherwise fine. Like the other thing was I'd fractured my leg, but actually the rest of me completely fine. I was really lucky that it was really just my leg. I just had my phone and I just sort of tapped away on that initially, just getting some thoughts down as it was happening. And as I said, I didn't really get real pain till after surgery. So I was sort of sitting there going, I've got a broken leg. It doesn't look very good, but I'm actually, I can't move around very well, I'm actually feeling pretty good. And I was even at the time thinking, bloody hell, I was pretty lucky there. It could have been a lot worse. The fact
and
that
so
I can,
your skin was intact,
yes,
and it wasn't open, no head injury, and so there's a lot of things to be grateful for. It could have been worse.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I suppose I was, and I wrote that stuff down at the time. Like I'm just sitting there going, "This is madness that something like this has happened. Never happened before. Obviously not ideal, but if the worst thing that happens is I fractured, I've got a mid shaft fracture of my tibia. Well, the odds are that that's going to heal. Like it might take some time, but you don't see a lot of people walking around with an unhealed mid-shaft fracture. It might take some time and there might be some hiccups in the road, which we'll talk about that have happened. But look, if you do follow the course that they heal, the odds of them healing with the technology we have these days is pretty good.
Yeah. When you're in the operating theatre in Sri Lanka, knowing what you know and faced with the uncertainties and things that you saw, how did you process that? How did you say, well, I need to let go and let other people take care of me here, and you had a general anaesthetic
I was talking all the time and I had like some of the guys who I know were looking after me, so that also helped because they knew who I was, I knew who they were sort of coordinating things. But exactly what you say, I think I thought at the time is I have very little control over what happens other than communicating as clearly as I can on my needs. And we talk about that a lot in patient care, that we want our patients to have autonomy to a certain level of that. It's a shared decision-making process. And that's something I really hold as really important in any injury recovery process, but any kind of interaction as a physio dealing with patients or with clients or with athletes is, you know, my job is not to fix the problem. My job is to be a part of a process that hopefully will allow us to reach a mutual outcome. That is what the patient or the person or the athlete's looking for. So in my case, my foot was facing the wrong way and I need to get it facing the right way. And so it was working out what that looked like, having the conversation. I remember having the conversation with the surgeon, said, look, I'm in your hands here. I can't do anything about this. This is what I'd like to happen. And he agreed. And, you know, it was a difficult place to do that sort of stuff because they have limited options with regard to technology, having different sized tibial rods. They didn't have what we would, you know, if you're in Melbourne, you can call up there's half sizes and different lengths and it's all available to you. In Sri Lanka, they had probably a cupboard with 10 of them and you just had to hope that you had the one that fit. And I was lucky enough, it was pretty close. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't definitely not the one we would have used in Melbourne, but it was good enough to get the job done of giving me something that would hold the tibia together so it wasn't flopping around. So, you know, these are the things that, you know, that I had no control over that. There was no other real option other than that to get the leg straight. I could have theoretically got them to straighten it up and back slab it, you know, manipulate it under anesthetic and back slab it and put it back together and fingers crossed. But it was a pretty significant fracture. So, you know, you'd rather go with get the thing in line and just let it settle. And that's basically what we did. And thankfully, all of the soft tissue stuff healed pretty well. It was a comminuted fracture. So there was bits and pieces in going in all directions initially. But, you know, the surgeon was pretty good. The one thing you find in a lot of these countries is these guys deal with trauma all the time. So he was a very experienced trauma surgeon. So he was good at sort of getting all of the jigsaw pieces into a place where they were pretty much fitted where they needed to be. Yeah. The interesting one on letting go is an interesting one. And I think, again, having experienced it from the physio side, you can go either way, couldn't you? You could go with the, I need to have complete control over this because usually I'm the person giving the information. And in this case, I wasn't. I was the person getting the information, hopefully having an understanding of it more than your layman. But even then, you know, I've never had a broken leg before. As I said, I've treated a few of them, but mainly I've assessed them, said that leg's broken and sent them to the orthopedic surgeon and seen them after they've, you know, had their 2-week review, 3-week review. I haven't seen, you know, physios don't, unless you're an acute orthopedic post-op physio, you don't see acute surgical repairs of tibias, ankles within the first 2 weeks post-op, really, unless something is either not going well or you've got a really close relationship with them and they want your advice. But if it's someone off the street who's just seen a surgeon, the surgeon's not sending them to a physio until he's happy that the surgery's gone right. So, it's an interesting thing to be there 24. And again, even as a physio, even in a sport where I'm working with athletes 20, you know, every day and many hours a day, you're still not seeing them for most of the day. As a patient, it's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You experience every up and down and feeling in it. So again, you can overanalyze it sometimes. And that's, again, one of the things I thought about was just let it happen and just relax and it'll do its thing as it does. Obviously, be aware of anything bad that shouldn't be happening, but the rest of it, it's going to do what it does because it's, you know, being bashed around a bit.
Mm. Having said all that, Susanna seems to have seen a disproportionately large amount of fractures in her work in Australian rules footy. So lots of stories of feet facing the wrong way in the middle of the football oval and that acute management and in a, you know, nothing you want to see. You don't wish that on anyone, but the opportunity to see that and then follow that person all the way through until their return to sport is, you know, is something that can be helpful. And also I was just thinking as you're talking and you mentioned, you know, you're describing your fracture as comminuted, not open. I'm just thinking of our first year physio students and probably many others around the world right now who are doing fracture healing this week. So there you go, guys. If any of them are listening to this, and I suspect many are not, but if they are, there's a real life story related to your fracture healing, but let's go back to pain, because I've really wanted to come back to the point about you didn't feel pain straight away. And we can only guess about the complex pain mechanisms at play there, but that's really interesting. You had no pain until after the surgery. What do you think was, do you think you just had higher priorities going on with your processing and your brain at that time?
I think so. I think exactly what it is. I think, you know, humans are very, you know, the human brain is very complex, and the whole thing, we don't, you know, we have a small understanding of how it works, but in practice under pressure, we know that there's a whole interplay of hormones and neurological processes that kick in that are completely subconscious, that we have no real conscious control over. And it's probably a really massive evolutionary advantage to have that in place, where there is no conscious requirement to get this done. It just happens in the background and switches on when it's needed, and it lives there waiting for something bad to happen to switch on. And hopefully you have it there when you need it. And I'm quite comfortable. I'm quite happy that it happened, because I feel like that allowed me to make some good, clear decisions when I was lying on the road going, okay, I've been hit by a motorbike. And I'd had, you know, having traveled a lot and lived in lots of different countries, you know, on my own in places where I don't know a lot of people, I have, you know, one part of doing that process is preparing for the worst, expect the best, prepare for the worst. So I had sort of war gamed it in my head of what would I do if something happened, who would I call, you know, who's your first, second, third phone call in those situations. And, you know, the problem was it was 12:30 a.m. on New Year's Day morning, so not a lot of people were answering their phone. But, again, I was lying on the road phone calling people with a broken leg trying to sort it out, and I did. So those things were good. The pain side of things, what did I learn, especially that acute sort of initial phase, pre-op, going into surgery, post-op, the learnings that I had were really interesting. So obviously that no pain initially, an awareness, once they'd kind of got it into a position where it wasn't completely facing the wrong way prior to the surgery and putting a back slab on it to stabilize it. Again, I was very comfortable lying there. They obviously gave me some pain relief. Mainly the initial phase was just IV paracetamol in Sri Lanka. Okay. And that seemed to work. It really turned down the any acute pain was definitely not there. It was an awareness more than anything else, but definitely not pain. And then, as I said, post-op was when the pain sort of kicked in, and obviously they upped my dosage of opioids and those sort of pain relief things. And it was the first time I've ever taken any of those kind of medications. I've never really had any injuries that needed anything of things like OxyContin and those sort of things, and it was the first time I've taken them, and they definitely work. So you can definitely see, you know, if the pain was ramping up and I took the OxyContin, within half an hour that pain had, you know, the dial on that pain had dropped down to a level where I was comfortable and I could sleep and do those sort of things. So that was an interesting experience to actually have pain that required significant pain relief, and the pain relief actually makes a difference to that sensation. The worst pain was probably in that first 24 to 48 hours post-surgery, but a lot of that was also probably from the accident. So yes, there was post-surgical pain, but I think also there was just the acute blood loss, hematoma. I lost about a liter of blood into my leg. So, you know, there was large hematoma in my tibia. You know, there's concerns about, you know, compartment syndrome, those sort of things. Thankfully, nothing too bad happened from that. But, you know, that pain probably was that. It was just a lot of pressure within my leg as my sort of body kind of adapted to this new fluid in my leg. But thankfully that settled relatively quickly and came back down. And then the other one was obviously having in surgery in Sri Lanka, I didn't have an anesthetic. I didn't have a general anesthetic. I had a Twilight and a spinal block. So again, so I had an epidural, and I'd never had one of those before. Again, I've seen people have them. I've talked about it to other people about what it feels like. And as a bloke who doesn't have babies, this is the only time I'm going to have an epidural, I'd hope. And again, I've seen them done. So again, I wasn't going, what the hell are they doing? Why are they sitting me up? And, you know, how are they going to do this? I'd seen it done before, but to have it done on yourself with a broken leg, sitting on a gurney in a theater with an anesthetist sort of poking around your back and going, you'll feel a prick. And then suddenly your leg goes numb. And you can't feel anything from your backside down was a confronting experience. And then waking up post surgery again with no pain acute, you know, there was nothing because I couldn't feel anything below in the bottom half, and going, oh, what, how long, you know, waking up going, how long does this last for? And you know, it's a good 6 or 7 hours. of nothing feeling between below your leg. You're like, oh, is this ever going to come back again? I remember calling my wife going, who's a physician. And she goes, I said, I can't remember. How long do these things last for? Because I really can't feel anything from the bottom out. Don't worry about it. It'll come back. Don't stress. It'll be fine.
I haven't had one, and I bet other people are thinking the same thing. Do you feel like you only have half a body?
Yeah, it genuinely feels like, I mean, again, you're aware of the weight of it, like it's there, but you can't feel anything. And this is a story, and this is a story I tell, and you know, this is probably a good forum to tell this story, during the anesthetic or the twilight anesthetic during surgery. So I'm lying on the gurney, put the anesthetic in, there's the epidural in, I'm lying down, they put the screen up. And then I get this twilight anesthetic and I'm, you know, drowsy and I'm out of sleep. And I'm thinking, that's it. I'll wake up and I'll be in recovery and I'll be home. No, that's not what happened. I woke up halfway through.
Okay.
And I wake up and I'm looking around the theater and I'm like, am I in pain? No, not in pain. What's that noise? And I hear this bang, bang. And it's when they're whacking the nail into my leg.
Wow.
And I look over at the anesthetist and I'm waving at her. Because I'm awake now and I'm waving at her and I basically wave at her and go, come over here and put me back to sleep again because I don't need to see this. But there was definitely no pain and no sensation of anything. Like I couldn't feel the hammering of the nail into my leg, but I could hear it and I knew what they were doing. So that was quite a confronting thing, but it was probably more interesting than anything else. Like I genuinely had no physical discomfort other than the fact that I didn't really want to be awake through it. And so that was an interesting thing that the epidural took. There was nothing. There was no feeling that there. You know, I couldn't tell anything about what was happening below the curtain. I couldn't see it because the curtain was in the way, and that's probably why they put the curtain up just in case you wake up. And wow. So yeah, but that was interesting. But yeah, so there was definitely nothing, no sensation. Which again, you can understand that conceptually that's the case, and I'm sure surgeons go, yeah, of course that's the way it works. Otherwise, we wouldn't do the surgery. But yeah, it was interesting for that to happen. And then again, as soon as you put me out to sleep again, I woke up in recovery and I was fine. And then the pain, once the epidural wore off, I still remember that pain starting to ramp up. And that's when obviously then I started to have to take the oral and IV pain relief. But again, it didn't last long. It was probably 5 to 7 days of sort of just being on top of it. And the thing I also learned was paracetamol works. If you've got acute pain, with, you know, and it kind of is going in waves and slowly ramps up with fatigue and other factors happening. If I took my regular paracetamol every 4 to 6 hours, you know, your 8 a day, it was definitely manageable. And then obviously for sleep, if I needed anything stronger, then I had an option for sleep. But during the day, if I was careful with my activity and did all the things right, like keeping your leg elevated and resting, it was fine. It was definitely manageable with paracetamol. So, you know, that's probably something that I need to be more mindful of when I'm educating patients is just, you know, if you've got something that's going to hurt because you've done something, then if you want to manage that and be more comfortable and allow your body to heal and be comfortable in that process, and there's a time frame that's going to take for that system to recalibrate and the inflammation to settle and the swelling to come down, then if paracetamol allows you to be comfortable and not be, you know, agitated and holding yourself in unusual postures and those sort of things because you're in pain, then use it because it's, you know, relatively low risk, low side effect option. And it works really well. And as I said, I'm now 7 days post a follow-up surgery and I'm just taking a couple of paracetamol as required, really, now. I'm not even taking it before I need it. And that's, again, seems to keep most of the symptoms under control.
You don't think about paracetamol as being so effective. But of course it is, but and you've described that and it's about being regular with it, and that's how it's prescribed.
Yeah.
But because it's over the counter, perhaps it's not associated with the stronger medications in terms of its effectiveness in a lot of people's minds. But yeah, that's important. And also asking people whether they, if they have been prescribed regular paracetamol, have they been taking it? Because that can affect your management and how they respond to the treatment and mobilization. So that's an important point. Well, that's a really interesting take on the pain experience, particularly the waking up during. I'm sure that's freaked a few people out, including me. Is that fairly common? Is that uncommon? Is it?
No, I think it happens. I think speaking to a few people, and I've got a few friends who are anesthetists. When it happens, usually it's, you know, they usually give you something so you don't remember it. So, there's a couple of drugs that they give you in anesthetics that can kind of stop your short-term memory. So it can happen, but you don't remember it happened. Or it's like a hazy dream. But mine was very much not a hazy dream. It very clearly happened. But again, that's the joy of being in a developing country where there's not that same level of, the patient experience in other places is not what we are used to in our first world system, where we try and maximize the comfort of the patient as best as we can with the resources we have available.
Yeah. It's important to reflect on how lucky we are in first world countries as well and developed countries, because you had a good experience and you had a good outcome. Yeah. And it's just interesting to reflect on the differences. Why don't we shift gears a little bit into our second talking point, which was talking about your change perspectives on things. So it's obviously any major life event changes your perspectives. And you mentioned that it's taught you how to appreciate the present moment let's think about how you might reflect that onto patient care as well. So that a bit of a mindset shift that you might have had during this.
I mean, we all know that being present is a good thing to do. It's not rocket science, and there's lots of research and lots of evidence to say that being present makes life a lot more simple and easier, and most people who are more aware of the present are happier and all those things. We know that. But in practice, how do you do that? What does it look like? What are the things that occur to make that a smoother process? And so I suppose with this sort of thing, where there's only so much that's in control in these sort of situations. And, the thing I think sometimes, especially as physios, I think we think we control more things than we actually do. We have a very limited palette of things that we actually can control. There's some really important things we do control. We need to make sure we identify those things and make sure we're putting in place as effective and efficient approaches to maximizing the way that we make those systems work. But in the big picture for me is, I'm a rehab physio. Like, a lot of the time I'm spending my time helping athletes get back from injuries, and the short, medium, long-term injuries. And we look at it from a big picture, right? We zoom out and we go, okay, what's the problem? We assess, we diagnose, we refer for investigation, we get second opinions, we do all those sort of things. We intervene as physios, or we send them off for other interventions. But we put the plan together of, okay, how are we going to get them back to the level they need to get back to for the athlete that they are, whether they're an elite athlete or recreation or just a normal person? What's the level of return that we need to do? You start with the end in mind, and you return and you do all that stuff, right? You work macro, and then you break it down and you go down to micro. And then what are we doing today? And as the patient in this situation, the macro doesn't help because it's too big and you can't see it, because right now I've got a broken leg and I can't walk. And that's the problem. And it hurts. And I can't wait. That's the problem. Whether I can run in 3 months or 4 months is kind of immaterial to me right now.
Or even day one in the hospital, you're thinking about discharge planning, and right now you're thinking about the pain and I can't walk. Yeah.
So the key is, the thing, I think you said something similar to it earlier, is empathy with the person with the problem, and it's the patient who's the one with the problem. So as a physio, that's an easy thing to do. As the patient, I'm the one with the problem. And then it's assessing what's that problem and how do we address that. As a physio, the thing I always say to my students and to my staff is, we want to meet the person where they are. We can't bring them to us. We have to go to them, and then we can be the guide. We can then be the GPS to help them. Okay, yes, you have this long-term goal that we need to get to, but you don't need to worry about that. You just need to worry about this stuff, because that's you. You're the one with the problem. And then we'll gradually get you to this long-term, medium-term, short-term goal that we have in the future. So as a physio, that's what we do. As the patient, you can't do both. You just have to be in the moment with the things that you can control, because it's a limited palette of things you can control. So when I was in the hospital, the first thing was, mobilizing, getting out of bed, being able to mobilize on a Zimmer frame, getting from the bed to the toilet. Those things were the first small steps. And again, we've all done this. We've all had to, as physios, we've all had to go through this process of helping people do this. But you said it earlier, putting yourself in that patient's shoes, is the thing that I think can make a big difference in the ability to meet them where they are. Because you can start to think, yeah, okay, you can't be the person, but you can start to try and see, okay, what are going to be the roadblocks for this to happen? How do I make sure that I'm being proactive in putting in place some solutions that'll mean that this is an easier, smoother process for the patient? You know, how do we set the room up? Can we make sure they've had pain relief? Can we make sure that there's a plan and a progression? Can we, once they've done it, can we say, okay, you've done really well today, and give them something to look forward to? Say, we've done this much today, and give them a small goal to try and push them toward the next thing, okay? And I think that helps because it gives people something that, again, a lot of the time they've never experienced this before. I'd never experienced this before myself. I'd seen it in other people. So getting some feedback out, like, you're doing really well, this is normal, this, that, those seems like small things, can be really helpful to keep you in the moment, to keep looking forward, that this is going to get better, that there's, and I think that positive spin on it of this will helps, because it means that your brain and your body and the system is primed to look for the improvement rather than looking for all the bad things that are happening. I'm stuck in hospital, I'm in pain. That's the natural way that your body is going to be looking, because it's not normal. It's all new, it's all different, and it's all not what you want. It's all things that are negative. But if you can say, okay, we can't have that as being the major driver for behavior and for feeling, can we make this a more positive experience? Okay, we need to look for the small positives that will help keep us moving forward and hopefully getting back better, quicker, all those things.
Yeah. And that leads really nicely to our third talking point, which was being proactive in your experience. So you were going to share some examples with us about how you were proactive in your own recovery. And I think in a way you have already touched on that, haven't you, in terms of you had three levels of people you might contact in the case of an emergency, all the way through to getting advocacy when you were going through surgery from your friends and your teammates and your colleagues, for example. And then as you went through the journey, how did you use being proactive to help you? And we can sort of talk about lessons for students and grads as well, working with patients for the first time.
The big thing is obviously communication. I think that the key point is making sure that everyone's on the same page, and then it makes life easier. If you know, and especially when I was in the hospital, again, very different setup to what I was used to with the way that it worked in the hospital in Sri Lanka. And there were lots of people coming in and out, and a lot of the time they wouldn't even introduce themselves. They just rock in, check my blood pressure, stick a thermometer in my armpit, and then walk out. And I'd be like, "Hey, mate, how you going? Who are you?" You know. And so part of that process was just having conversations with people about, okay, what are you here for? How am I doing? How is my blood pressure? You know, finding that information out, which is, again, not normal for the system that I was in, but I needed to have that information because it gave me some agency and some control. And then communicating, for example, with the surgeon about, you know, as you say, about discharge planning, about all those sort of things, doing that early and doing that consistently and regularly as things change. And sometimes as the physio, that's our role. As a patient in this situation, I was both my own physio and the patient. But remember, a lot of the things when you're a physio in hospitals, part of it, this is a long time ago for me, but having now experienced it again, I remember it, is that our role is to help with that discharge process. And we need to be thinking about that from the start. You know, where are they going to? Who's looking after them? All that stuff. And, you know, the good thing is, My training kicked back in, and I remembered all this stuff came back to me that I hadn't used in a long time. And that process is not, I think I wrote something about this in a LinkedIn post. You know, this is not a different process for a return to play for an athlete. It varies by degrees, but not by form. So the key is that the process is the same of deciding, okay, what are we trying to do? What's the outcome? As the physio, you know, in sport, my job is to know the demands of the game and the performance level of the athlete, and then be able to objectively say that this athlete is ready to return to play, or for me, it's return to perform. You know, working with elite athletes, performance is the key. Playing is not the key. Performance is the key. And I need to be able to justify my decisions with some metrics or some objective ways of quantifying their return to performance at the level that we expect them to be at when they play. And so for me as a patient with a fractured leg, okay, I'm not trying to return to play elite cricket or football or something like that, but I am trying to get out of the hospital and get back to my apartment. And what do I need to do that? What are the systems I need to have in place? Stuff to help me shower and get around the apartment and all those things. That process is the same. It's more about, so it's not, learning that process is what then allows you to think that clinical reasoning process allows you to then just, as you move through the gears and the levels, that same process just repeats. Now, the way we do it, the systems we use, the technology, the testing, all that stuff will change, but the underlying hardware that lives underneath is the same. And I think people forget that. We overcomplicate it, probably is what it is. And I spent a lot of time going, no, this is a simple process. Okay, it's complex because we're dealing with humans and we're dealing with complex systems, but the process as physios is a simple process of identifying the problem, providing some solutions, and then some objective ways of measuring whether our intervention has actually created an outcome that we wanted based on the processes that we've put in place.
It's almost it's something that you can get drawn into pretty easily, overcomplicating things that are complex and trying to gather all the information and losing track of the simple goals of the person as well. So that's interesting. And then what about our students? Let's just think about students and grads here. How do they keep things simple? So they're in a hospital rotation or clinical placement for the first time. They've got a lot of complexity all around them. Their mind's buzzing. How can they do a good job of keeping things simple?
So I've got a really good example. So last week I had to go back into hospital in Melbourne to have some follow-up surgery. The fracture that I had, despite the surgery being quite an effective surgery for that acute phase, over the last 12 weeks we have got some fracture site movement and the callus formation has been not as good as we'd like. And so the process from a surgical point of view has been to go back in, remove the rod that they put in there, realign everything, put a plate in and put a new rod in, which was a better fit for the fracture I had. Now, you could say that that's a backward step to a certain degree, but the process was really about trying to avoid further surgery. So we gave it every opportunity to heal without any further intervention. It didn't happen, which can happen. This is the thing about any kind of injury, that there's setbacks at times. But we planned for this. We knew this was a factor, a risk that could happen. It's happened. We've had the surgery. So I was back in a hospital last week, and it was so happened that the for my discharge, not only in overnight, for my discharge the next day, obviously I had to mobilize, and I'm currently mobilizing on two elbow crutches, so I had to be able to get up, walk around, go up and down a step, all that sort of stuff. And the physio, who didn't know I was a physio when she came in, got the student to come in, fourth year physio student. And I wasn't very nice. I didn't give her an easy run. I said this to her. I said, look, the good thing about this is I can give you some really quick feedback. And I know they were busy because it was a morning discharge morning, and there was plenty of patients they were trying to run through to get out of the hospital. So I said, you're not going to get a lot of feedback from your supervisor because she's busy as well. So why don't we use this as a practice run? And do a proper assessment on me, and we'll go through it. And the thing I remember how hard it was. So it wasn't like I wasn't cruel on purpose, but what I the thing I remember as she was doing this, and it wasn't for me and for experienced physios, we forget that the process that we went through to get to the point where we can quickly get information from a patient becomes second nature. It just becomes what we do, and it's part of our system because we know the information we need and we know the kind of questions we need to ask to get that information. And we almost forget that there was a learning process that got us to that point, a bit like driving a manual car. When you're first starting, it's all very mechanical and process driven, but now you just drive the car. And even if you haven't driven a manual car for a long time, it takes about 30 seconds and I can drive a manual car having not done it for ages, because it all lives in my head. It all lives in
the curse of knowledge.
The curse of knowledge. So, which is good and bad. It's got positive parts to it, but there are also negative parts because you can get into bad habits that you don't even notice you do. Mm. But in this case, the thing I, as I was experiencing this and sort of living through the experience of being interviewed for an assessment and then both subjective and objective assessment, where the physio who didn't know me, a new physio didn't know me, had to get a history and work out a plan. The big thing is having a system and a structure to your assessment and being very clear about the information that you want to get. Now, what is the information I need to make decisions? And that's probably the big thing I think about. Why are we asking these questions? We're asking these questions so we can make some decisions. It's not just asking the questions for the sake of asking the question. It's about making decisions about what are we trying, you know, what is the decision I need to be making in this moment? And then that allows us to choose the correct questions. And independent of the timeframes we have and the resources we have, we can then prioritize those questions to make sure we have the right information to make the decisions. And so in the context for students looking at it from a, you know, especially these sort of orthopedic type, return to activity, both from an acute phase, even through the return to play point of view, is the questions have to be about how to, and this is the objective stuff I was talking about. These are both subjective and objective questions, are about trying to ascertain how is this information going to change my decision-making. And so, for example, in this case, me getting out of bed, what do you need to know? Well, what's happened? How are you feeling? What's the pain like, you know, while you're lying in bed? I hadn't been out of bed yet, so this is going to be the first time. And then having a look at the, you know, objective measures of can you move your leg, all those sort of things. It doesn't have to be fancy. This is the thing, again, we can sometimes overcomplicate this sort of stuff. It just needs to be simple questions that give you the patient can answer, and then continuously reviewing and reassessing to make sure that the information hasn't changed, and then be able to then titrate the intervention to match the information that's coming back. So, you know, for example, for this, you know, I hadn't got out of bed, so this is the first time, you know, so, you know, how's my head feeling? How am I feeling pain-wise, pain relief? You know, can you move your leg? Yep. Okay, let's sit up. Okay, and then repeat. And how's that feel now? And then can you stand up? And you know, all those steps of going from sitting on the bed to being able to walk up a step, you had to be continuously reviewing and assessing and obviously observing and giving some objective measures on my gait pattern and weight bearing status and all those sort of things. So how does that then correlate to what I do as a sports physio? Again, it varies by degrees only. It's exactly the same, but I'm just measuring different things. And I suppose the thing I think about and one of the things I constantly talk to my staff and to my athletes about is my job as a physio is to not just look at things objectively where we can test lots of things. We can test strength and range of movement and power and speed and agility on GPS. There's lots of technology we have in elite sport. But actually, a lot of my skill as a physio is my eyes and pattern recognition to look for aberrant patterns that are really subtle, to look for small things that may not be picked up. They might be too small to be seen on some of the measures that we use because it's just it's a subtle difference. But with experience and with learning and with seeing lots of things and knowing the athlete and knowing the person and what normal movement should be and what we're aiming for, we can then give some objectivity to that by looking at how do we assess this aberrant movement that we're not seeing. So for walking up a step, how are they doing that? Are they transferring their weight correctly? Are they using the crutches correctly? How are you doing that? And for me in running sports, you know, how are they accelerating? What's their ground contact time like? You know, what's their foot position at foot contact? Those kind of things, which may not come up on any test that we can do, but if I do a video, if I take a video and look at it slowly, I can see there's a difference between what they were doing before and what they're doing now, or from one side to the other, or whatever it is that we're using as our kind of measure of change over time. And then we need to put in some interventions to see if we can change that.
Mm. So if we think about going back to putting ourselves in the shoes of a student now, we've been in the shoes of a patient for this episode so far. And if you just ask yourself the question, why are you asking these questions? And how will the information you get from these questions or these tests change the management? It's a pretty good place to start if you don't know why you're asking a question as well, which can happen when you're a novice learner and you're in a foreign environment, you've got lots of things going on. That's the other thing in hospitals and inpatient environments. There's a lot of other stuff going on that doesn't necessarily you're not necessarily exposed to in the university, we've got simulation, a program of simulation that students go through before they go on their placements in our course, and other courses have that too. Just a little bit of exposure to all the noise and the hustle bustle of the hospital, but nothing can really prepare you like going onto those placements and seeing it for the first time. But having a system is what you said, having a system for getting that information and for and knowing what that information will, how it will change your management, keeping things simple. And then you acknowledge all the complexity that's going on beneath the surface.
Mm. And I think the key to that is, you know, especially when you don't have that knowledge base, you have to look at all of the options. You have to, the decision tree has to be the full gamut, because you can't rule out anything unless you have responses to those questions that allow you to remove those from the decision tree. And so when we're doing those sort of problem lists and that process, that's what you're learning. That, you know, and as much as I don't go back to that as a experienced clinician, I am doing it all the time. It's just that my pattern recognition is a lot quicker, and I've seen enough stuff that I can quickly remove things just by, you know, from the knowledge that I have of the testing that I'm doing, the questions that I'm asking. But when you don't have that knowledge, the key is having that system, being very consistent about just repeating it. And it becomes very, I mean, it is, it's supposed to be boring. The point of any, just like driving a manual car is a very boring thing to do when you don't know how to do it. And it's really hard and it's challenging and it hurts. But at some point, and you never know that day when it happens, when it becomes subconscious, but it happens, where suddenly you're suddenly driving without thinking about where second gear is or where third gear is. It's the same process. It's just there's a more complex steps to it. There's more steps to it than just moving a gear from one place to another. There's a whole under surface of problem solving, clinical reasoning, and critical thinking associated with all this stuff that lives beneath that. But the process is the same, but repetition is the key. And I think that's probably the thing I think about with this sort of stuff, is just repeating it. And making mistakes is probably the other thing. You know, like you have to make mistakes, because otherwise you don't learn when you miss something.
Mm. And then the process of reflection and having mentors and having good stopgaps around you so those mistakes don't become critical as well. But what about in the less acute, subacute rehab environment? What about 3 or 4 weeks after the surgery? You might be seeing the person on a home visit or in an outpatient setting or private practice, or you yourself may be the patient. So how did you stay motivated throughout your weeks, your 12 weeks of rehab and then another surgery that you return to? So let's talk about motivation and long-term approaches to things.
Hey, look, it's really hard. There's no doubt about it. Like, it's really boring. There's no way to sugarcoat it. Doing basic, simple rehab exercises, doing, you know, muscle stims, and there's, you know, when you're non-weight bearing, you're trying to let a bone heal, you're trying to, you know, minimize fracture movement, so you can't do that much load through it. It's a very boring, repetitive process. You can't, my ankle dorsiflexion range was rubbish, but I couldn't do anything to make it better because I couldn't put more force through my tibia. So I just had to keep what I had as best I could. I tried lots of other things, you know, again, having worked in elite sport and done lots of different things and speaking to AFL footballers, if, you know, ask them, if I was an AFL footballer, what would you be doing with me to try and maximize bone healing and stimulating muscle, you know, recovery to make sure I'm not losing too much muscle. So I did things like blood flow restriction. And as I said, I've got a TENS unit and I had bone stimulators. I basically threw everything at this that you could throw at it. It makes small differences and it makes it more interesting. Otherwise, it would be really just sitting there with some TheraBand and doing some quad setting and, you know, some glute work and some, you know, couldn't even really do much calf stuff. So, you know, the key with it is probably being able to mix it up a bit and give some variety within the constraints of the restrictions associated with the injury is really important. Otherwise, it is really difficult to maintain any kind of motivation. And I think motivation is probably the wrong word to use. You can't motivate yourself to do it. It just has to become part of the routine, that this is part of my process to getting this leg back. I need to do this stuff to make sure that I'm in the best place possible to get back to being able to recover as quickly as I can when I can start to do more. I think the other thing was recognizing that it's okay to lose some ankle dorsiflexion range. Like, it's not the end of the world. Like, people go into a moon boot after an Achilles repair for 6-7 weeks and have negative ankle dorsiflexion range, and it comes back. Okay, it might take some time, but it comes back. There's nothing wrong with my ankle, thankfully, but it's stiff. And it's going to take some time to get back, but it will. If I do, you know, once I can be able to load it, it will come back. And I suppose having those metrics for return to activity is really important. So having some goals of, okay, this is what we need to have from a quads activity, no quads lag, full active extension, knee flexion as tolerated, and obviously limited initially, but then how quickly, can we gradually progress that knee flexion range of movement, ankle dorsiflexion, muscle strength as available, but a lot of unloaded sort of stuff. You can still get muscle activation with and strength work. It's just a lot of reps. You just got to do a lot of reps.
Yeah. The goals are so important. We often think about the goals being, if you had to guess the patient's goals, there would be performance or at best functional level things. So I want to return to basketball, return to tennis. But you're right, in the long-term rehab process, especially when you're working really closely with someone and you're sharing the data that you're getting, you're measuring things and sharing them, quite often there are impairment-based goals and the patients come in and, I'm so happy, I got another 5 degrees of knee flexion. And the first time you see them, they wouldn't know what 5 degrees of knee flexion is, or ankle dorsiflexion in this case.
So yeah, having those milestones is the key to any sort of long-term rehab, both to help make sure that you're putting the right intervention in place and you're giving them the right stuff to do, but also to give you that feedback that, yes, this is a long process, but we need to see the ball being moved forward. So having those milestones and part of my planning when I'm doing long-term rehab is very clearly, obviously, having your kind of return to play, like return to training, return to play, return to performance criteria and sort of some metrics for that. But even before that, some milestones and some exit criteria to move through the different phases of rehab, whether it's, protection, load introduction, training integration, all those sort of things. And so for myself, I've written a program for myself in the same way I would do it with one of my athletes. I've written a kind of a macro view program for myself with some goals in place that I need to sort of meet again. And that can be a motivator. So for me, it's like, these are the things I need. This is, today I need to go and do my exercises, knowing that in a week's time, I need to be able to do this. And 2 weeks after that, I need to be able to do that. So today I need to do this at this level to kind of make sure. And that's probably a big factor. Me doing my exercise today is not a motivator for me. But me going in 3 weeks' time, I need to be able to walk with 25% of my weight going through my left leg for a K and a half. I need to have some muscle to do that. That's my motivator.
Yeah,
and this is the work I need to do now.
Yeah, there's like another car analogy. I'm not motivated to put petrol in the car. I'm going to do that because I want to drive somewhere. And it's
exactly
that's important to remember. And so you did your own program, which is, of course you did.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah. I was definitely not listening to somebody else's program. So.
And that motivation is going to follow. So you have everything set up and then you're doing your metrics and your little goals and you're working towards a bigger outcome. And the motivation is going to follow that as you see the progress rather than waiting for the magic motivation. And there's been so much spoken about that over recent years, the balance between discipline and motivation. But that's a really good example. And then you've got the mental resilience on our list of things to talk about. So, obviously there's downtimes as well where things are really hard. So, and everyone's different. Some people that naturally have different levels of resilience and have different circumstances. So what are some things maybe you could take away from your experience to help people maintain a positive mindset through their rehab journey?
I think, I am lucky because I am a person, I am a positive person. I'm always looking for the positive. I've taken this as a learning opportunity more than anything else. And most people go, what are you talking about? You've got a broken leg. Why would you take this as a learning opportunity? But it is.
Well, that's why we're having the conversation, because you were documenting that. That's really interesting. Let's talk about it. Yeah.
So I think that mindset helps because it means that that automatically puts you in a frame of mind that means that you're looking for opportunity to learn, to progress, to push. And yes, there are days where I'm like, I have no motivation to do anything. I'm just going to sit on the couch. And again, it's a great there's no reason not to sit on the couch. Like me recovering after a surgery last week, the best thing I could do is stick my foot up and lie there for 2 or 3 days is the best thing I could be doing with a couple of ankle pumps and these sort of things. So having a mindset of knowing, again, it goes back to a little bit about the things you can control and the things you can't control. Knowing those things and go, okay, I can control this little thing. I'm going to do that as best I can, but there's all this stuff I can't control over here. So I'm not going to worry about that at this point in time because I can't control it. And then slowly, hopefully, we can gradually increase the part of the pie that's the controllable part, and the uncontrollable part becomes less of an issue. But, you know, especially when people are in the hole, right? You know, where they you know, deep down in the hole. And as I said, as a physio, when you're trying to build that empathy and that rapport with a patient, our job is to get in the hole. You know, is to get in the hole with the patient and say, okay, you're not there on your own. We're going to do this together. And I know I've got some skills. And as a student, you might not have the skills, but you can still get in the hole.
Yeah.
And then together you can work out how we're going to get out of the hole.
That's really important. You can always help. Everyone can always help someone. Doesn't matter what your level of experience is.
And it does. It's not about that, because when you're the person who's not, you know, lacking motivation, you're in pain, you can't do what you want to do, you know, it just feels like it's too much. And so as soon as, you know, there's somebody who says, no, I understand, I can see that it's hard, but this is what we're going to do together to try and help. And we'll do it together, and we'll make this decision together about what we're going to do. And then we'll review, and you can tell me how you feel, and we'll go from there. And I always think about it. It can happen really quickly. It doesn't, you know, this is not something that can take hours and hours of work. It's you know, it can happen within 5 minutes of suddenly it feels like really dark, and then someone comes in, turns the light on, and then you sort of feel better. And that's that thinking feeling connection is so interrelated, that being able to tap into the thinking can change the feelings, and the feeling can change the thinking. They can go both ways. So being able to use that as a clinician is a really important tool. And it's not, there's no magic to it. It is really just being present with the person, listening, you know, like really listening to what they're saying is enough. That's sometimes all you need to do. You don't need to do anything else. Mm. And in that process of doing that, then allows you to then hopefully be able to use your skills and actually try and implement some strategies that will actually change it. But sometimes just starting with that base level of listening to the person and where they are allows you to then engage and build from that process.
And anyone can do that. You don't have to be qualified or even have started a physio degree to do that. That thinking, feeling, connection, that is cognitive behavioral therapy. But if you call it that, it sounds all medicalized and a psychology degree to do it. But that's, you know, that relationship between what you're thinking and feeling is so important in rehab, managing setbacks and getting in the hole, as you said, with people and meeting them where they're at at that stage. So, you know, it's more than just the impairments, the muscles and bones and joints. I mean, we've talked about quite interesting things and surgeries and comminuted fractures and all number of orthopedic physiotherapy and orthopedic things, but it comes back down to the person and in connecting with them. And which is why we're having this conversation, because you've had this experience and you're a highly experienced health professional. And I've learned quite a lot from that in terms of what you can, how you can see it from the patient's perspective when they're going through their rehab, but also, you know, just how you might just approach the day-to-day interactions and the boring things. Now, rehab's boring, as you said. Many weeks of the same thing, non-weight bearing and waiting in waiting rooms, waiting for MRIs. There's a lot of boring in between stuff, in between seeing people, that it's worth thinking about as well. So
yeah,
you're going to see some really good insights into that.
Yeah. And I suppose in summary, the thing I think about is that the thing that I've taken away from this process is not necessarily it's going to make me a better physio or a worse physio or anything like that. It just means that, and I'm not saying that you have to break your leg to be able to have to go through, you don't have to go through this kind of trauma to have this sort of insight.
Yeah.
I think what it's set to me or kind of the learning that I've taken from it is that engaging with process is the key to outcome. And again, you can understand that theoretically, but as soon the actual fact of, okay, I know the process, I'm engaging with the process, review, repeat. That's it. And so whether you're a physio, whether you're a patient, whether you're a student, that's it. Knowing what the process is learning. And that's where you have to have education and reading and knowledge and mentoring and all those things to work out what that process is. Cause you don't know, I don't know that as a patient, I haven't known that. I've had to learn that in this experience because I haven't been a patient before. But the underlying systems that drive the way of getting the outcome that we want is this, you know, problem solving, critical thinking, clinical reasoning process is the same process. But again, it's repetitive because that's how it works. It just has this iterative improving spiral that hopefully spirals us up out of the hole.
And if you're listening to this and you're impressed by Tihan's insights, and just remember he's been doing this for 20 years. You're the same age as me.
Yeah.
This attrition from the workforce is a big, big issue in health professions. So, you know, it takes years. You just stick at it and have these processes and can just keep going, keep learning from your patient, learning. And I don't even like the word patient, learn from the people you're working with. That's a really good insights there, Tihan. I really appreciate you coming on and having a chat. Is there any other final thoughts, or do you feel like we've covered everything here from your perspective?
Thanks, Luke. No, I think we've covered lots there. We've had a good chat, you know, and thanks for the opportunity to have a chat and have a discussion on some interesting thoughts for people. Hopefully they're useful.
Very good. I'll remind everyone you've got the Cricket Physio website that they can look up, and they can put your name and I'll put the link to that in the show notes. The LinkedIn posts we're talking about, well, you have to look at them on LinkedIn. That's where they are. So you can, I'll put them in the show notes as well. And the Physio Social Club podcast, have I got that one right? With and John and the team.
Yeah, so we've got a podcast looking at helping physios and other health professionals, looking outside the clinical aspects of being a health professional, and looking at and some of those other parts to our careers and some of that things like workplace attrition and burnout and all those other sort of kind of things that we don't necessarily talk about as clinical physios. That are really important. We like to call it like the lunchroom of your life, of places where you'll have those sort of informal chats. We've got a podcast that talks about that sort of thing. Physio Social Club.
I wish these things were around when I was a new grad or a student, but you know, the world keeps improving. And good luck to you if you're young and you've got access to all this stuff. But you know, that's really good. You've got a place there to think about things that aren't necessarily going to be in most of the podcasts and professional development forums. And we've talked about mentoring quite a bit on this podcast and on this episode. So a chance to connect to some physio mentors. So get into it, everyone. Have a look at those episodes, and I'm going to go and have a re-listen to them as well. Well, that's all. Thanks very much, Tihan. Really appreciate you coming on, and we'll hope to do this again soon.
Thanks, Luke.
So everyone, until next time, this is Tihan and Luke wishing you all the very best with your studying, professional development, and lifelong learning.